Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I hope you've all had a great day today. There's a couple of things that have just come across my desk. If you're interested in calling in, this is an open line show. Anything goes. You can call in at area code 267-521-0167. That's area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, the number is 855-346-3351. 855-346-3351. So let's see. Where did I want to start off? I just saw that a press release across the wires from the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry. It's a press release in response to the Human Rights Committee, maybe, or Commissioner. Human Rights Committee. So it says press release, July 21st, 2014, moving backwards into the future, it asks. On Friday, July 18th, 2014, the Human Rights Committee took a historic step backwards in considering paragraph 19 of their draft general comment on liberty and security of the person. The committee declined to either prohibit mental health detention as discrimination based on discriminatory grounds or keep silent and thus indicate the need for reconsideration of the jurisprudence in light of the new perspectives brought about through the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Instead, the Human Rights Committee decided to retain some version of the paragraph in the current draft, which endorses mental health detention subject to, quote, necessity and proportionality. And so anybody who's working on the Human Rights Committee, on the Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities, any of the United Nations going-ons, if you'd like to call in and talk about this, we are going to be scheduling several shows with some of the people who are intimately involved in making some of this advocacy at the front lines on an international level in the near future, including Tina Minkowitz. And but this press release, excuse me, my voice has been flipping. This press release from the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry continues. Human Rights Committee member Walter Kalin, sorry if I pronounce these names wrong, spoke first after Rapporteur Gerald Newman introduced the paragraph and presented the committee with the three options. Mr. Kalin argued for its deletion in order to take the time to develop the committee's own approach to harmonization of the standards in light of the evolution of human rights and the development of new conventions. Following Mr. Kalin's intervention, which we supported for reasons similar to his own, one member after another all spoke in favor of keeping some version of the existing text. And I'm guessing this existing text is the endorsement of mental health detention subject to, quote, necessity and proportionality, whatever the hell that means. So on an international level, like, they are, you know, it's perfectly legitimate, I guess, within the framework of human rights. If it's necessary and proportionate to detain us for, quote-unquote, mental health reasons. So the press release goes on. Some contended that it was necessary to keep this paragraph in order to signal that the committee is not ignoring people with disabilities. However, the committee appeared unconcerned by the signal it would send to persons with disabilities to maintain discriminatory and harmful standards and to go against the claims presented by their legitimate representative organizations. It was also said that this committee could decide to maintain lower standards than the Committee on Rights of Persons with Disabilities. We would like to remind the committee that it is not a question of lower standards so much as incompatible standards. A standard that endorses mental health detention with regulation gives aid and comfort to those who operate such detention systems, which deprive persons with disabilities of their liberty and security of the person on the grounds directly linked to the existence of a disability in violation of the CRPD, the Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities. So this is all very, very complicated and fascinating. The press release goes on for some length, and then concludes, "We urge the Human Rights Committee, when it meets next Tuesday and Thursday, to resume its second reading of the draft general comment, to take the sensible approach and ensuring its continuing relevance to promotion and protection of human rights of persons with disabilities." And so they are looking to revise outdated laws and practices. And so this is, at the level of the United Nations and all of the work that the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry are doing, certainly the Center for Human Rights for Users and Survivors of Psychiatry and others, of which I guess I should mention that I'm on the board of directors of, there's a wealth of information. And if you'd like to look at World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry's website, to get some information about this, because, all of the activism that we're doing in the United States and everything around the Murphy Bill and trying to get our rights protected, there is also a huge international movement also in line with this. And there are many people who are in the U.S. who are involved with that, but that this is much bigger than just the U.S. And so if you don't know about the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry, you might want to check out www.wnusp.net. So it would be World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry, wnusp.net. And from there you can also get to links to all kinds of just a phenomenal amount of information. And so I think that there's, the work of this idea as to whether or not it is within a human rights framework to be able to hold somebody for mental health detention, which is, for example, what the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day 72-hour vigil was, to call attention to the fact that anybody in New York can be detained for minimally 72 hours and assessed and treated and so on and so forth. There is a line 202, your line is open?
Yes, how are you doing?
I'm good, how are you? Long time no speak.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry. I just recently discovered them, and that this is an international movement to, and the abuses that are happening worldwide. And in fact, I think the hope in the United States that we have, I think the only hope, well, that's not the only hope, but I think that we need to bring international attention to the abuses of psychiatry. And it's a longstanding strategy that many groups that have been oppressed go to the international realm. I mean, it goes back to the early even civil rights days in the 20th century. And I think that because what the strategy I've seen in the last few months seems as though, for example, in the Murphy Bill, is that I don't like to use this word, but I guess it's the forces of evil. What they have done is they've become like a hydra. We've cut them off by fighting Murphy Bill, by fighting maybe the laws that are happening in New York. And what they're doing is they're just coming out and just going all over the place. And I think drawing attention to the fact that these are international violations is probably the only best way to go. And I would invite people to go to that World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry and actually become a member. And I'm going to repeat it again. I always say when you're on, Lauren, that people should have pencil and paper at hand so that they can write down things, because some of the things that we hear that are repeated, but it's worth a more in-depth look, WNUSP.net. WNUSP.net.
Right, and so the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry, if you go to their page, their About Us, About WNUSP page, it, you know, bullets out that it is an international organization of users and survivors of psychiatry. It advocates for human rights of users and survivors of psychiatry, speaks internationally for users and survivors, promotes the user-survivor movement in every nation around the globe, and links user-survivor organizations and individuals throughout the world. And so this is a phenomenal resource with fabulous leadership and, you know, people really, really a membership organization that is out and about doing things. And, you know, through emails, I've been communicating with Tina Minkowitz about doing several shows on kind of informational shows of maybe like, you know, breaking down over several weeks on the United Nations, on the Human Rights Declaration of Human Rights, and then the Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities, the Convention to Eliminate Racial Discrimination, which I understand there was just a major paper that went out about that, right? And so there's all of this on the conventions, right?
Yes.
And so to even explain, like, if somebody's listening and doesn't even know what the conventions are about or whatever, that so Tina and others are going to be coming on, and we're going to do a series about efforts that are going on an international level in the near future, probably in the fall.
The reason why this is important, because what I see is that some people make this about, this is about human rights, and some people make it about an access issue, and this is where the split is there. The split is there because some people want to say, well, we just want to, they use this as an access. We want to have more and more people to have access to psychiatry. And they negate the fact that psychiatry has been intrusive and has been damaging to people. And that's where the split occurs there, because people are not everybody, but many people that want to say that human rights activists like yourself are, you know, off the page, but it's not. You know, just like someone said, well, isn't it a good thing that we're going to have early intervention and screening of people?
No.
But the answer is what? No, it's not really a good idea.
No, the answer is no. And this is why I'm getting kicked out of places left and right, and that's okay. You know, I think that people are where they're at, and I don't need to be everywhere. But it does really, really upset me that, that a conversation can't even be had, and that simply, you know, making some statements against legislation is enough to cause this kind of response. But also that, you know, people are really fooled. That is the only thing I can really think of. They are really... the idea that early intervention is going to lead down any road other than young people getting drugged and forced into this stuff, and, you know, when they're older, being subjected to things like involuntary outpatient commitment or being in line to be institutionalized because they have a psychiatric history. I just don't see how any early intervention or assessment or anything that is in the Barberville 4574 is going to be a solution. It just adds another whole set of problems. I mean, it does one thing. It preserves SAMHSA and SAMHSA-funded programs, right? And then anything on top of that it does that's different than Murphy is create this mass response to... you know, have all young people targeted, and young adults and veterans. I think we need to be really specific about these things. And he is very specific about these things. He's pro-force treatment. He was shot by somebody during the Gabby Giffords-Schubert shootings, and he is pro-force treatment. He believes that if That person had been identified and treated, that he or Gabby Giffords or anybody else that day would have never been shot.
Well,
and that's
about
what it feels about.
The last week or so, I've been doing some intensive thinking about this. And what I've come to my own conclusion about is that people want to make this about a medical issue when it is not. They want to make it about an access issue when it's not. So therefore, when human rights activists like yourself or other people come up, we have to come up with a different strategy around this. When you come forth and you start talking about it, what they want to portray is that we are keeping people from getting medical help. And I think that it's not the case. Number one is, even if that is the case, they don't have enough services for the people who voluntarily want this. And I think it's a way of sorting people and putting people in categories so that you can use anything to detain them. Because it would be the same thing about asking people about their sexual orientation. Why do you need to know? And it's a trick. And people don't see that. They want to do the screening before that there's any services that are available. You know, it's to put young people, especially anybody who, I live in Washington, D.C., and to have anybody where people are going to sort and categorize you and you put something there that's going to deter people. And I believe that people should be out about their, I'm out about my psychiatric history. But it forces people out of the closet. And I don't think that you should do that. I think that would be a strategy that can be used now, because it will force people. You know, someone is 12, 13 years old, and they have some normal reaction to something. And now forever in perpetuity, they have a label on them that might interfere with their ability to get employment, to get a security clearance, to
be able to roam freely from county to county if somebody is saying that they should be in treatment and they don't want to be. In so many levels, and for the rest of your life. And with the electronic medical records and all this stuff, there's no burying it anymore.
I'll give you a good example of that. People that are listening in that have had or are now engaged with psychiatry or either some kind of counseling, if you ever abuse drugs or alcohol, I mean, ever so lightly, and you go in to any place, they will have, even though that might have happened 10, 15, 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
that is still, they still say, they still ask the person a question about their substance abuse history. And they might say, well, I would say in my case, I said, oh, well, sure. When I tried to kill myself, I took all those pills and I took six bottles of Rolling Rock at the same time. But that's not to say I'm a substance abuser. But guess what? It sticks and you can't get it off. And I think that's the thing that the approach that I would say is that a good approach to have is that you get it sticks, and no amount of whatever you've done for the last 2 years, 3 years, 10, 20, 30, 40, it cannot be rubbed off. And I think that that's maybe another kind of approach to have about the screenings that they have, because anything, you know, you could be 11, 12 years old and you lost your grandmother and you had a normal response to that, or young people the most dramatic thing that happens to a lot of young people that have emotional distress are divorce of their parents, breakups, first love, whatever, questioning about sexual identity. So forever in perpetuity, you are going to be judged, sorted, categorized by something that may have taken a small amount of your time. And then what I say is, if somebody is in real distress, do you have services or whatever else that might support or help that person? And that is no. So I think it's not a matter of just access, because that's what those people want to say, is that human rights people or anti-psychiatry people are trying to keep people who need help to get access. I mean, Jared Loughner, if you think about it, and I guess I can't remember the guy's first name, Choi. Actually, I met him, Choi, from Virginia Tech, because his family had a dry cleaners in Chantilly, Virginia. The thing about it is that there is no way of predicting who is going to be violent and who is not.
Right. And it was Sung-Hoi Choi, right? Sung-Hoi Choi?
Yeah. Well, there's no way of predicting that. And, you know, to look at someone and say, well, their behavior is odd or whatever, and in the case of Loughner and the guy in California, they had YouTube stuff out there that would have told many people that, you know, this person is in distress, but they couldn't get help. Choi, same way. You know, some of the things that that a person may, in a screening, may show up, they still don't have resources to help. So what is the good of screening all these people? And
right,
then,
I mean, but the other side of this, Yvonne, is that, you know, Jared Loughner and any of these young people that have done this, whatever the reasons were, whatever could have or couldn't have been done to suggest that they are us, and that they are the overwhelming majority of people who are psychiatrically labeled, and that their psychiatric label has anything to do with what this is, or that there's any evidence for any of this existing, and that they can be somehow connected. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's one thing that, yeah, you can't predict who's doing any of this, and even if you could be flagged by it, there's no way to really tell who's going to do what or to be able to be everywhere at every point in time. But then to suggest
that these people are models
of who it is that has a psychiatric history, that's just as criminal. Like, you know what I mean? The way that then psychiatric profiling happens, that this is somehow, this person, Jared Loughner, somehow represents people who have psychiatric histories across the world, that's ludicrous. They are, very often we are the furthest away from what the experiences that Jared Loughner had, and so it's criminal on so many levels. Just
it's like the only way I can compare it is to a civil rights analogy, you know, early 20th century. After the Civil War and Plessy versus Ferguson, we had a movie called Birth of the Nation. And it lionized black men as roaming the countryside looking to rape white women. And this is the same thing. We have media and that is going about, and I think people are purposely doing this, placing stories to try to say that, you know, that persons who have a psychiatric label, and like I said, the example I gave of some things that might happen in your life, anybody could get a psychiatric label now. And basically it's because for you to get any kind of help, if you want some kind of support, sometimes the way it's paid for is somebody has to say that there's something wrong with you, not to say, well, you're having some difficulty and you need some support. So this is a conscious thing, and I one thing is I check on, and Lauren, you might want to do this. I'll send you a link to it. There's a thing called clout.com, and it categorizes stories on the Internet. And I've seen a pattern over the last few months. People are, it seems like a placement of stories. A lot of times I post things, I don't really believe it, but I think that we should comment on them because the conclusions that they come to about some of us with psychiatric history is so wrong that they have to be corrected. And what happens is you repeat the story long enough, or that line of thinking long enough,
right,
that people come to think that it's true. There's one blog that's circling the Internet now saying, sort of saying, people do need to be on drugs for the rest of their life, and don't do this, and, you know, do not go off your meds. There are some of these stories, and they're getting high profile on the Internet. And you and I know that it was never intended for us to be on these chemicals for the rest of our life. They have very negative consequences. You know, I just watched a commercial on TV today where they talked about, I'm going to call the name, can I call the name of the drug?
Sure.
Abilify. And Abilify, as I understood it early on when it came out, was supposed to be a kind of an antipsychotic replacement for Haldol and some of the other drugs that had, you know, significant weight gain and other side effects. Well, now they have like a cartoon, and they say, well, you know, you feel like you're stuck. They're starting using our language now of talking about what's happening to people. You know, your antidepressant might not be working. You need Abilify. Then at the bottom, they give you all the things.
Yeah,
the negative things, like you may experience weight gain.
It's not a replacement for an antipsychotic for an antidepressant, I believe. It was supposed to be one of the newer antidepressants.
Well, early on, Abilify, I just had this noticed anecdotally, so, you know, I may not be correct, but people that I knew that were taking some antipsychotics and some mood stabilizers too that complained about.
Oh, that absolutely could be. I'm not doubting what you're saying. I'm just saying now it's being marketed as a antidepressant.
They jump. Things that were strictly antipsychotic, they found multiple users. I compare this to rice. You know, when I was a kid, you went to the store. There was only one way you could get rice. And that was you got it in a plastic bag or a cotton bag, and that was it. Now how do you get rice? You get it microwaved. You get
ready
it already
to go,
cooked.
Flavored. Sure, sure. It's got all of its variations. I mean, I just want to jump back to one thing that you were saying, though, before. I mean, not only is it problematic to me that they keep on holding up these mass murderers as people who have psychiatric histories, and therefore all people who have psychiatric histories need to have social control and be drugged, but also the idea that psychiatry would have had any answers for this. Psychiatry does not have any answers for these kinds of things. And so they're adding this lie into the situation that if only Jared Loughner had been seeing a psychiatrist, or if only, and then you look at overwhelming a majority of them who were getting psychiatric, drugs. And so then what? So the idea that psychiatry is going to stop this from happening is just as heinous as the idea that people who have psychiatric histories, that is what is causing somebody to do these kinds of heinous acts.
And you since you are a professor of psychology, you may know a little bit more about this. And I can say I've been doing some deep thinking about this. And one of the premises is when people come to the psychiatry, it's that there's something wrong with you. This whole notion that your brain is broken versus you're having problems interacting. you know, that you're not able to, you're having a social problem of being able to interact for some of these people, interact with females.
Well, I don't know from a perspective of psychology, but I do know from the perspective of a psychiatric survivor that it wasn't me that was saying that I needed something. It was the people around me saying I needed something. I wasn't making myself uncomfortable. I was making those near me uncomfortable. And I think
it's sitting with your uncomfortableness. But I'm referring to, and maybe I'm not doing a good job of explaining it, is that sometimes you're having difficulty navigating the world. And people have difficulties navigating the world, and the way people deal with that difficulty is different. And sometimes people need some kind of help navigating the world, as, you know, just as, not saying this is an excuse or anything for it. This is a young man who grow up and they want to have relationships with females or people that want to have relationships, whether it's female or same sex or whatever, and you have difficulty navigating that. The answer to that is not, like you said, they don't have any answers. The answer to that is doesn't come in a little small pill.
Right.
And it's not saying that talking therapy does not help some people, but like you said, psychiatry doesn't have very many answers for it. And when you say, well, when the mantra is, like I said, I'm seeing this on the internet, and I have some of these little stories on my Facebook page, and I'm going to put some on your Facebook webpage for the radio show. Is that there is this several stories out there now saying, look, don't stop taking your medication, as if there's a wide group of people out here telling people to go cold turkey off their medications, and this is the worst thing that could happen, and there are people giving testimonies like, you know, I did this, and it had disastrous results or whatever else, and, you know, to try to prop it up, because, like I said, there's every day and every night on television and radio, there are these ads. And these ads, the first part, they pose a problem, and they give you a solution and a little pill, but before they end their commercial, they give you all these bad things that could happen too, you
know? And I think, you know, it's interesting that I'd be interested to know where this wave of people talking about coming off of these drugs are. But I think that, you know, we've talked really in depth about things like the harm reduction guide to coming off of psychiatric drugs and alternative ways in which people can titrate down and to, you know, to be aware of the fact that the withdrawal from this drug is as bad as the withdrawal from any street drug, so it's not something that should be taken lightly. And so, yeah, I mean, to be able to start, you know, but they're going to do, I mean, obviously the voices of people who are speaking out against Murphy are getting them all riled up, you know. And so on some levels, people are making an impact because they're having to respond in different ways and create more lies about why these things need to be put in place. Yvonne, stay on the line, but area code 330, your line is open.
Hi, it's David. Lauren.
Hi, David, how are you?
I'm hanging in there. Hey, I was listening. I remember reading Desmond Morris's The Naked Ape, and it seems to me that, you know, historically, that when populations, you know, become unsustainable, so to speak, like especially in a democracy, when you got one faction or, you know, one part of the demographics kind of thing, is one population tries to outbreed the other one, and then another one comes in, and they try to outbreed it, and, you know, it's, you know, it gets to be horrendous. And I mean, look at the poor Native American Indians and their spiritual experience if they go on, if they were, you know, if they were to say something about their spiritual experiences, they would probably be locked up, you know, as insane. So it, you know, it's all, you know, there's a lot of cultural bias and a lot of different aspects that play into it, especially when all the jobs are shipped overseas and stuff like that. And, you know, we got more population, less jobs, so there's going to be more crime. So, I mean, you have to create jobs, you know, if you get what I mean, to, you know, to create more of a, you know, the illusion of a sustainable
So they're trying
culture.
To create more parole officer jobs? Is that what
No, you guys, cool. I don't know the
books that you're referencing or anything like that, but yeah, I do to some degree get what you're saying. But I think that this is the amount of criminal anything that is really being done by people. And in other words, any criminal action, in my mind, it's not a legitimate response to say that had anything to do with anything that was psychiatric, of something that there can be no evidence for.
Yeah, well, you have a parole officer, you got a case manager, a social worker, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and, you know, and variations thereof and stuff like this. So that it creates more jobs, so to speak. It's, if you look at it, the medical industrial complex in America is growing by leaps and bounds. I mean, look at these hospitals; they're just growing and growing and growing. I mean, we're not building up, you know, an arsenal of tear gas or bullets and this. It's more, you know, you got, you know, it's a sustainability issue. From my perspective, that's all I can say. I mean, I don't like it, but that's kind of the nature of the beast. I was told this by somebody who worked in the, the consulate or something like this. So, I mean, it's not like, you know, we're like DuPont's building up more napalm factories and stuff. So it's, you know, it's kind of the nature of the beast. And, you know, you got one person accusing these people of that and this group accusing that these people or that person of this, and it's, you know, it just goes on and on. It's like, you know, the people keep accusing, and that seems to be the biggest problem, as far as I can see, except for, you know, disabling people in order to have, you know, people, you know, STNAs come in and help them, and case managers and social workers and all this kind of stuff. I mean, I've got a therapy dog. I'm afraid to go out and walk it because somebody might call the police on me for merely having a conversation, you know. But that wouldn't be the person I'm having a conversation with. It's somebody in a car somewhere driving by that feels threatened or something. I can't believe what's going on, but it, you know, it does. You know, that, like you said, this whole bill that you're talking about it creates more jobs. And you said, David,
it creates a ton of jobs. Even the thing that was passed in 4302 in the Doc Fix bill, where they snuck in the involuntary outpatient commitment, the assisted outpatient treatment programming, it pays for people, it creates jobs for people to go find people who qualify for the law, to file petitions against people, to create the plans people are going to have to, it funds everything and their mother except giving some kind of actual concrete support to the person who supposedly needs it. You know?
I saw in Cincinnati there was guys going around at their homeless people, and they were rounding them up, and they were all being labeled there. And I was told it was like a racketeering. I'm walking down the street, and somebody tells me I got to walk with this group in order to be accepted. And I'm like, I don't walk with any group, especially when they tell me I have to. That to me seems like racketeering and strong arming. So I, you know, but then they started saying stuff, you know, that all, you know, about, like, you know, serial murders and belong to the same demographic that I'm into, or that I belong to, and serial rapists. And I'm like, Well, you know, I guess percentage-wise, that might be right, but you don't have to put me in that. But that's, you know, I mean, people, you know, they got jobs, you know, and they got to create the. I mean, it's almost like slavery. You know, you have to have a case manager, you know, to watch over you. You know, be a good Toby or something like this, and don't speak up.
I've argued it's like slavery in the DuBois dissertation. That was a big part of what I was arguing, and that the HMOs or behavioral health organizations and managed care companies and whatever are like the slave trade, where they're buying and selling us for the you know, least amount of money for the least amount of services, most amount of services that they can push into us, totally creating jobs for all these people. Yvonne, I think I maybe heard you saying something, or...
Yeah, I was just laughing about this because this is so true. I remember about 7 years ago when I used to work for behavioral health. I had a contract, and I had someone to call in, an agency person called in to complain. Now, I listened to this very carefully, and anybody that knows anything about public health, they had a client of theirs die. They were looking to help bury the person, okay? And all the resources, we have a lot of resources here in the District of Columbia. They had gotten all these resources, and they gotten everything except for $250 that they needed to help bury the person. The person went to a day program. Not only did they go to a day program, the agency had them in their housing. So they got that was the second highest billing. The first highest billing would have been ACT services. The second is like day program. They were in the day program. They had this person for 20-some years. They had them in their housing, so they were getting a subsidy for that. They were in like a group home where they were taking all their money except for $100. But yet they couldn't find $250. They still were searching after the city had given them all the subsidies, all the Salvation Army, everyone had kicked in the little part. They still couldn't get $250. But you know that they had, off that person, they probably had made over $1 million.
Over time, sure, right?
Over time, yeah. They had made over $1 million. But and they took all of their money. This is what they do. I don't know in other places. They can take up, because sometimes people that are in these group home situations, they take all of their money except for like $100. They had taken all of their money. They got billed at the second highest rate every day for the person. They had them in their housing that was in their name, where they were getting, you know, this huge amount. So it is like slavery. That's why I'm just laughing about that.
It is. And if anybody hasn't read Thomas Saz's 1977 Psychiatric Slavery, and in 2004 he did a follow-up called Liberation by Oppression, a comparison of chattel slavery and psychiatric slavery. And so, you know, these aren't new things. As a matter of fact, in the 1850s, Phoebe Davis and others, while slavery was active, right, before it was supposedly ended, they were writing their experiences of being locked up in asylums and comparing it to the experiences of people who were held in slavery, except Phoebe Davis wrote that the slaves in some ways were better off than the lunatics, because the slaves needed to have their bodily function in order to serve the master, whereas the keeper of the asylum got paid whether people could move or not. And
it doesn't have to be big institutions, because you have lots of little mini institutions like these group homes. I understand in New York they have board and care places where they take every
single room occupancies and all that. Yeah, where people are just being robbed of their, like you said, you know, given $100 a month of their the money that is due to them.
That means you have, think about this. And for many people who haven't had this experience, what your $100 have to go for? That means all your personal toiletries. If you're female, your hygiene products that you might use if you're still having that monthly cycle. If you happen to, you know, like cigarettes or something, all of that, close. That $100, everything has to come out. I remember going around and trying to get consent from people to be involved in we had this kind of study that goes on constantly of people and how the system works. And, you know, I'm just trying to get consent, and a woman was asking me for, she wanted some dresses. And, of course, they would refer her to the, you know, they, thrift stores and whatever, but they didn't even want money or different places like this. Your $100 has to go. Think of how humiliating that is, that you may not be able to have a new item, new
right, and that's $100 a month, folks. That's like not $100 a day, not $100 a week, $100 a month.
Compound this from
the glorified life of a mental patient that people are, you know, committing fraud about, right?
Just bear with me, Mom. Compound this by the fact that your provider, and they've stopped this a little bit, but the person you had to go to get your $100, maybe they decide, you can't manage that $100. So every week or 2 weeks, you have to go somewhere where they give you $20 or $40 to parcel out to you. That means you, you know, when do you go and have a sit-down lunch or something in some place?
Yeah.
You know, when do you get a chance to go to a movie? And, you know, if you have a long period of where you've been economically deprived like this, I mean, it's going to affect how you interact with everybody. So it's, they're making money off of people left and right, and then they still can't be satisfied. You know, I remember someone said, well, we've got to put in a treatment plan how people are dealing with their prospect that they might die. You know, it's... you know, the you know, you they would say, if you've not had the person for this amount of time and they haven't talked to them about planning for their last days or whatever, well, $100 a month, what can you do? I remember once when it was used to be $80 and it got up to, when they got the little increase to go up to $100, and at the time Marty Nice was our director, and they got some additional increase in the subsidy, and the department says, well, that should go to the client, and the group home operators, they would say, oh, our margins are thin enough as it is. We need that $20. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just really ridiculous, and there are many more people that are in these board and care and group homes. Assisted living, it's the same thing if you have a person who's a senior, because places are not above placing people who have been in the psychiatric hospital for a long time in nursing homes. And they do the same thing. They can take almost all of their money except for, depending on which state, it might be $100, it might be $80, be $120, but still it's a minute amount of money. And they don't, in those living conditions, they can't come and go freely. You are an adult. If you're married to somebody, you don't have the right to have them come in so that you can consummate your marital being. You can't, you know, you many places people have to be in by a set particular time. So here you are, an adult, being treated like you're a child. So it is more than just slavery. It is an oppressive system, and you have to look at not just people being in hospitals, but people being supervised. And that's when you have the potential of having people marked as having being labeled and whatever else makes a person subject to living in that kind of environment. Because, you know, we've coupled mental distress and dangerousness together, So anybody can be swept up and taken up. Think about the young man in Stafford, Virginia, who had autism and who had a label of autism, was just waiting for the library to open and got snatched up into the criminal justice system because he didn't want to be bothered with the resource officer. Resource officers, like in a school where you have, you know, police officers or people that are there, and he got swept up in that. So, you know, it is.
And it's still doing today, right?
Yeah, and it's a very oppressive type of system. And this is how we had to paint a picture of what can happen, because it's not what can happen. It's not all Orwellian. It is what is happening. There's plenty of examples of that happening to people. And if you have people sorted and categorized, anybody, if you ever lived in a, people that are out listening, if you live in a, don't live in a large city, but you live in a county, a rural or suburban area, your sheriff has a lot of power. So if you're driving down the road somewhere and you have a sheriff who doesn't like you or knows about your labeling, he has a lot of power to detain you. And given that sorting and labeling that could happen with early detention, you could even, be killed and justify the fact because, you know, you had a label.
Based on what those in power are wanting, right? David, what are you, high class, high social class targets or something like that? You know, those who are in power, if this is the way they want things to move, then that's the way everybody's going to move with it. And
looks like whoever writes the history books are the one, you know, they always claim to be the, you know, they were, you know, whoever writes the book is the one, whoever writes the, you know, if, you know, they continually write things down about you, you know, to a fine decimal point like they did in Nazi Germany, then, you know, if they got the power structure, they got the power structure. I mean, you got to look at religious factors and a lot of other things were involved in it. And then, you know, you would think people would have evolved into a higher state of being by this state, you know, by this time. But I don't know. If you read Desmond Morris, it makes some sense to me, because once people breed beyond sustainability, then society begins to implode on itself. I mean, the land is only able to sustain so many, you know, plants and animals, and then of course human beings too. But it's, I mean, to me it makes sense. It's like, you know, it's like if you plan this Armageddon kind of thing, or this thing. Of course, it's going to happen if you breed to an extent that there's hardly enough land amassed to sustain the rest of creation, and it's gonna have an ill effect on the in the environment and everything. So it's, you know, it's like, you know, I remember upon leaving an institution, a psychiatrist said, if the court wants to hold you here, I think you should be free. I don't have any problem with you. He said, but welcome to reality. You know, and that's the way he felt as a psychiatrist. And he didn't like being manipulated by the system. But, you know, again, it comes down to, you know, they have to feed and clothe themselves. You know, people got loans to pay off. You know, they got bills to pay. And if they don't do it, they lose their house. They lose everything. So it's a very complex.
Yeah. It really is, I just think that it's so important that, like, we remind ourselves and the world that there is, like, this world thing also that is, you know, outside of all of this, there is this operating environment that is either going to be, you know, good for us or hostile toward us, depending on how we continue to treat it. And that's part of the reality that people are set up in. And then the reality of people, you know, if you're working in one of these places where you're not allowed to speak out, even like the psychiatrists, like you're saying, you know, that they've all got to play the game too, and that this is part of how people become Stockholm Syndrome, of where they, love their captor and want to, you know, take care of their captor because their captor is taking care of them.
Well, some people, it's kind of like they get involved. I tell people all the time that if they feel like, for example, having counseling or therapy is beneficial to them, that they don't have to, they can go elsewhere for it. And it seems to be, I can't imagine, this is 2014, they just can't believe that, you know, that they can take whatever insurance they have, whatever, to go somewhere else. They just think they have to be captive to the public health system. I don't know how many people, they tell me all the time, but, you know, it is like a slavery in that they're economic slaves for somebody else. They're worth. So people think about slavery as, well, they're not out there working and doing anything, but they're being held captive. In some cases, people are being captive in poverty because
Their work, and Goffman talked about this also, is that their work, their job, is to be a mental patient.
That's right.
Yeah, they have to be sick.
Don't lose a check now.
What's that? Yvonne?
They have to be sick.
Go ahead. David, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they have to be sick. It seems to me like all these side effects create more, you know, illnesses that have to be dealt with. So it's just an endless cycle until it burdens the human, you know, body to the point that it can no longer take it and dies. You know, I mean, it's akin to Egypt in a sense. You know, you just keep burdening and burdening and burdening, and then you know, more medication upon more medication, and you know, the client eventually dies, but at least they had a good life. You know, we didn't have a long life, but we gave them a good life, so to speak.
They didn't have a good life. They had ESP, eating, sleeping, taking prescription medication. What it is, ESP. Like I gave that example, the person being probably giving that agency probably over their lifetime $1 million. It's the same thing as you were saying. It's an industry. And each person, whether it's a pharmaceutical company, whether it's the, and I know people will say this all the time, nobody goes into the business of being a social worker or psychiatrist because they think they're going to get rich. But they themselves are the pawns, too, of the whole system, because everybody's getting paid except for the person who's being used as a petri dish.
Right. They may not think they're going to get rich, but they think they're going to get paid. Like, you know, like, it may not be the most lucrative of jobs, but they're still getting a steady check. And the person who's being tortured inside of all this isn't. And how different would that be? Like somebody, maybe it was you, Yvonne, but somebody on the other night was talking about, you know, the amount of time, or the amount of money that a year of institutionalization costs, that you can be in a 5-star hotel every night for the same amount of times, like 3 or 4 times over, like having everybody like cooking your meals and cleaning your rooms and doing these things. Why are we doing this? This is creating jobs for psychiatric workers. And the Murphy bill just adds right into it. And the Barber bill even more than the Murphy bill, which is...
But there's a reason why state hospitals, I kind of think this is how I approach some of these people. This is why they should be against Medicaid being billable for hospitals, because the truth is, in most states, at least where I live, it's over $200,000 to keep somebody in the state equivalent of a state hospital. It's over $200,000 a year to keep them there for years. Like $238, something like that. But I'm not going to quibble over tens of thousands of dollars. But it's a good little chunk of money that it costs to keep. And for the amount that people get in a the amount that a hospital gets when they have someone in a private private hospital. You know, this is private hospital is not enough for the kind of security and everything else they have in the state hospital. So this is why I would think.
Just over $200,000.
Yeah, just maybe, you know, give or take 10, 20, 30,000, you know, whatever.
Okay.
It's more than that.
Right.
But that's what it costs to keep somebody for a year. That's whether it's forensic, whether it's civil or whatever, if they take that. So it costs more. They cannot bill a private bed in a general hospital enough. So that's why I was saying that on some of this stuff, there's a natural ally is, you know, they have mental health facilities in a lot of counties and places that are not exactly the state hospital, but they get all this additional money. They could not operate on the because the billing for Medicaid. That's why they have many people go to state hospital now because they use up all their days, and so
right.
they. Have to go to rather than say, hey, why are we having, you know, 15, 16 hospitalizations for this person? You know, they don't look at that. They go now directly from the private institution here. You don't go anymore to the state hospital directly. They will triage you to a private bed. We only got like 250 people in the state hospital. But we got over 1,000 private placement beds all over the place. So
right.
they go there and they will stay. They think their stay is going to be more than 2 weeks. Then they send you to the big house.
So I'm just wondering. So it's 200,000 and change each. There's the three of us on the phone. I'll be the first to admit that I use alternatives to psychiatry. Would the two of you deny that kind of statement? Do you deny that you have some involvement with alternatives?
Oh, definitely.
I'm researching. Excuse me.
I'm sorry, David. What's that?
Go ahead. Yeah, I'm researching. I look at yoga and things like this. You know, the body is a temple and all that kind of stuff. So, there is things, and I can't totally say that everything is wrong with, you know, quote unquote psychiatry. It's a difficult thing because I know people who say if I don't get my medicine, I'm going to harm somebody. And at that point, the physician had. I mean, I would just lock them if I was a judge.
Well, sure,
judge,
because
say,
they're
well,
going to go through withdrawals. They're going to go through withdrawals, right? I mean, let's not forget that little factor inside of it. But my
but
point,
after,
my larger. Yeah,
but getting
you
back
to yoga
and
because you're going,
right.
back
but my
the
larger
quarter,
point here, my larger point here is that would be just over 600,000, maybe 700,000, just the three of us. I have this bit of audio right here from Murphy, who is one of the things that he's trying to do is take away the SAMHSA alternatives conference, and so I'm just going to play this audio right now, and then maybe we can kind of reframe that of this idea that just the three of us would be just over $600,000.
Do you think in the alternatives conference, which spends about $600,000 a year of taxpayers' money, do you think we should be paying for conferences that have things called Unleash the Beast, Primal Movement Workshop, How to Make Collages, Dancing, Interpretive Yoga, or How to Stop Taking Medication? Do you think taxpayers should pay for that?
I think it's very important that we have an open...
Do you think taxpayers should pay for those items? When we get so short on funds, do you think we should be paying?
So,
this is the thing about it is that I quote my mentor, Mary Ellen Copeland, saying, you know, low-cost, free, non-invasive tools. And you asked the question of me. One of the biggest things I thought is a help, and I'm having a problem getting it back now, was a CPAP machine. I have sleep apnea, very bad. And a good night's sleep, anybody who has been in emotional distress or I shouldn't say anybody, but most people would tell you that a good night's sleep is the most wonderful thing that you can have if they only can get a good night's sleep. So I have to say that a CPAP machine for me, not a pill, is a very good thing. And working on sleep hygiene, other things that I do to try to make certain that I get maybe not a full night's sleep, but, you know, get 4 to 6 hours of sleep a night. Those have been very helpful. And for years I took a pill. But I shouldn't say a pill. I took a cocktail, okay? And but what has worked mostly is working on the sleep hygiene, because even if a pill would knock me out, the next day I couldn't hardly do anything. It was more disabling. You know, I have to say I was one of those people who said, I didn't get a good night's sleep until I was 2 years old, and they gave me that pill. But the thing about it is I couldn't do anything else. So, yes, I use alternatives, and they are free, less costly than the and I don't take those night cocktail anymore. It took me like 7 years to get down, and I have a very good psychiatrist who encouraged me to get off of medication, of course. That didn't occur until after I had gained a lot of weight. But, yeah, I think that Murphy is off balance. I think that these medications are so expensive. Hospitalization is so expensive. And that's not to say that there is some people who may have to be on these medications and may have to have these interventions for a small amount of time. The 5% of people who are really, really...
I disagree with that. I think that that's making his argument for him, Yvonne.
I'm just saying for a short time. I'm saying that not that everyone has to be on these for the rest of their life. When I was up and I couldn't get any sleep for 4 or 5 days, but that's an episode that a person may have, you know, maybe a couple of times in their lifetime. Not that you're going to be on, have these interventions for the rest of your life, that you have to be in a day treatment program where you're supervised in a group home or whatever else for the rest of your life. It's like if you have an infection, no one says you should take penicillin for the rest of your life. You got cancer, no one says you got to have chemo or radiation for the rest of your life. It, you know, may be something that you use intermittently. So I'm not saying that there's 5% of people that should be on these things for the rest of their life. I'm just saying that we should be exploring the cause of whatever's causing the emotional stress. And that's not what's happening. People are just covering stuff up. And therefore, that's why, you know, when I was hospitalized, I was totally compliant. I was taking the medication faithfully as prescribed, and I had side effects from the medication that put me in the hospital.
I think so. It's hard. I think sometimes myself, if I can't sleep, I know my conscience might be bothering me at times. So, you know, if it's keeping me up, then I've got to, you know, I got to all, you know, go to the left and quit going down the same path all the time. So it's difficult because I suffer from it, but at times, and I know that if you don't have sleep and you drive a car, they say it's as bad as drunk driving. So your mind and your brain, I mean, is affected in such a way that it's as bad as being intoxicated. So you really not making the best decisions with a lack of sleep. It's you know, some people might say it's a form of psychosis or something, but it's due to lack of sleep, or maybe, you know, and who knows what causes it. But sometimes for me, for instance, it might be, you know, my conscience. And, you know, thank God I got one. You know, I mean, I'm grateful I'm not a psychopath or something like that. But you know, there are people that do benefit from, you know, therapy and stuff like that. I mean, I've seen things on television like child killers, you know, and one person was because they were their environment they were raised up in, and the other one they couldn't figure out, but then the other child grew up and was still murdering. Where the other one, the girl was her parent was a prostitute that was in the, you know, S&M, and that was what she kind of was imprinted on her. So she changed her behavior.
But there are monsters. There are people that I think that a lot of times people want to categorize and say that when people do bad things, that's out of the mainstream of decency, that we have to say that they got some kind of illness. And I think that there are things as monsters. There are some people that are just, they're just evil. They're evildoers, I don't think that they are ill. If you take, they're just monsters. There are some people that, and this is, I know people may disagree with me, but there are some people, they're just not meant to walk among the rest of the human race. You know, if you took whatever that their evil doing away from them, they wouldn't be anything. It's so imprinted on them, you know. And they're just evildoers. They need to go to the bad places up under a rock and stay there, you know. They're not...
That's where crime and punishment comes in, I think, on that. I would hate, but the laws are the laws, but that's, you know, and I'm talking about the higher laws, and, if, you know, a foot for a foot, a eye for an eye. If people just go out there and keep killing people and they get other people to do it, and that somebody's got to stop it. That's how war stopped. If they were stopped immediately, you know, quick, if justice was quick, then like things like World War II might not even have started, you know.
But let's talk about some of those other alternatives that Lauren was talking about. You had mentioned
yoga.
Well,
I wasn't really talking about alternatives. What I was talking about, what I was trying to make out, was the point that Murphy is dragging the alternatives conference out like it's such a problem and talking about it costing $600,000 a year when the three of us, if we were locked up for a year, would cost more than that.
Sure.
And so that was all my point was. My point was. But I think that, you know, things that we just mixed up a whole bunch of things together, and if somebody is just listening, I want to just, you know, clarify. I think one of the big problems is, like, Yvonne, you brought up sleep apnea, for example. I think, like, a big problem is that sleep apnea isn't a physical, the diagnostic criteria for sleep apnea is found in the diagnostic statistical manual. Like, that's where... if you have sleep apnea, you're considered to have a psychiatric disorder. That is, even though it's a physical thing, make it a psychiatric.
Oh, okay. Well, I go to
you know
pulmonary.
What I mean? It's absolutely a physical thing. It has different ways in which it manifests. Ways that your breathing gets prevented from being clear throughout the night, or whatever the word is, just easy breathing.
Right.
But the actual diagnostic terms of sleep apnea is in the DSM. It's the same thing that if you struggle with math, there's a mathematics diagnosis in the DSM. So
really?
Yes. And so it's very important for people to understand smoking cigarettes is a psychiatric disorder. Weighing too much, weighing too little, laughing too much, laughing too little. These are all things that are literally in the DSM. It's just important for people to understand of who is getting caught up in here. And there are always these sensationalized stories of, people who, murdered somebody or killed somebody or whatever. But this is not the bulk of people that we're talking about. This is not, and to be creating laws based on these kinds of conversations, the way Murphy and them haul out these heinous acts, associate violence with it,
not only that, it's just what you're pointing out is that the DSM, which is the Bible, for people that don't know it, the Bible of that has something for everybody. That if there is a person who could not find something with their name on it in there, I don't think it exists. I think Paula Kaplan, I remember hearing her speak, and she said it was meant to explain all human behavior. And anybody can be diagnosable. I think that's what you're saying, is anybody is diagnosable, so therefore the way they couple violence, everything together, anybody could be picked up and detained and held. You could be killed or abused, and just saying that you're mentally ill, like that woman that was on the highway in Los Angeles where they the policeman beat her up, and they didn't take her to jail. They took her to a psychiatric facility, but she couldn't see her family for a week.
Right, and I think it's just really important that people understand that, like, anything falls into it. Even, like, restless leg syndrome is in the diagnostics, the DSM. Circadian rhythm disorder, obstructive sleep apnea. Like, if you just look, there's a whole new bunch of changes in the DSM-5 of how they've overhauled all of these things. And so, you know, like, there's also, you know, things, and so some of these are physical, actual physical things that are known to have actual physical causes that are then lumped into psychiatric terms and psychiatric treatment because it falls under sleep. And so that there's so few people who are escapable of any of this kind of diagnosis, and then all you need is a diagnosis in order for it to
make your rights not really make you not really a first class citizen. Because, like I said, the people being sweeped away, or like you talk about the postpartum depression, you're saying in New York State that they want to have everyone screened for postpartum depression
and all their children screened.
So, because we had a case here in Washington where some woman came from Connecticut, and in fact, they just ended the investigation. It was, I don't know, some while ago, maybe less than a year, where she took the wrong street, and she ended up being lit up by the police. She had a little baby in the car.
Yeah, Alexa.
And,
Yeah,
they went to her house, and because this is what they'll do. They'll scour your, to try to find out why they killed you. They go get your computer, your cell phone records to find anything. And as you said, the DSM is so pervasive that it's like nobody can escape. So even a bad shooting or a police harassment or whatever else can be. I don't know, did you see this story in New York State? I think it was in the New York Times where this, I don't think that there's any mental health issue, but they're going to try to make it like it is. But this 350-pound man said that he was being harassed by the police, and he asked them to leave him alone, and they put a chokehold on him, and he's asthmatic, and he died.
No, I did not see the story.
I'll send that to you, but that's I was surprised. That was a front page story. It happened to be African American, and I'm just waiting for them to try to bring up some issue of mental defect or mental illness with him just to justify why they were harassing him over a period of time. But the point is that DSM is so pervasive that it can be used to justify anything. And the simple strategies like yoga or maybe a little more costly, the CPAP machine, where you say there's real physical reason. And then there's some other things where there might not be physical at all. Like if a person is having a spiritual experience, I mean, why do you have to try to medicate themselves? They just can't function, you know. I mean, they're going to tap it down a little bit, but they're still going to hear voices or have that spiritual experience, but you're going to make the person disabled. I think that I was more disabled from the chemicals than anything.
Do you think in the alternatives conference?
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, more disabled from the chemicals. More disabled by the chemicals.
Yeah.
And it really. I mean, and that's what they're designed to do. I mean, they're, to control people, and drug people and make people not be able to think clearly and to be easy to control, to have them do as they want. I'm sorry, there's just a lot of background. And so I think that these are really concerning and that we need to continue to speak out about it. And, I don't know at what point who's going to start being the people that wind up successfully holding Murphy and Barber and all these folks accountable for the fraud that they're putting out there. But I do think that somebody should be holding them accountable. I myself got blocked off of the Murphy page, off of Representative Murphy's Facebook page. So I am no longer allowed to post there. But I know others are, and people have actually offered to post for me, and I appreciate that. But I think that we need to somehow get to the public attention of what's going on, and quite frankly, when it does get to public attention and there are articles that are written about it, they get buried. And, you know, I think that's also partially part of the problem, is that people don't want this perspective aired. They don't want it given any attention, and they want it blocked out of the conversation.
And by the time it becomes widespread alarm, it'll be too late.
It becomes harassment, too, at that point. It's like I was calling up my mom's physician and saying, hey, she's drinking on her hypnotics, and, it could shut down her brain. She's taking Benadryl, cough syrups, all these things. And he had somebody call me and say, if I kept calling him, it would be phone harassment. And I wasn't accusing him of negligence by any means. I was just like, I need some help. I'm very concerned about my mother. But, I guess the lawyers come in, and it's all of a sudden it's a liability issue. When it wasn't, I was just making him aware, but I think he freaked out. So, it's horrible. And then you get these people, I hate to make World War II references, but Hitler himself was on benzodrine and cocktails. That God knows what they were shooting up into that guy. So he was, it was chemically induced insanity, If you're on benzodrine for too long, you're gonna go into a psychotic state, from what I understand, or if that's the correct definition, I don't know. So it's a difficult bugger on how to, disable it or disarm it, so to speak. I mean, because if we look at it, does he get kickbacks? Where does he get, where does his money, does he get money from these drug companies? What's going on? I mean, that could be held into question, too.
It's Murphy, I believe, gun lobby. Because it's to the advantage of the gun lobby to divert. We're being diverted. This is what they do in civil rights movements. They try to make people distrust people who are their natural allies. So they divert us from the real issue of guns to mental health. And that's what this is about. That's what it's about, is diverting people's attention from saying we don't need to have guns in this country.
Oh, I 100% endorsed it. I got an NRA hat myself. I can't have a gun, but I endorse it. It's legislature. I mean, that doesn't mean I can carry a weapon, but I believe you know, people, law-abiding citizens, have the right to defend themselves, for God's sakes, or, you know, with all the stuff that's going on in today's society, you know, that leaves me prey.
There's no reason to have 5,000 rounds of ammunition if you say you're going hunting, you know. You know, but that's what it is the people are making so much money. Just like the pharmaceuticals, they're making so much money, but the people that sell these semi-automatic weapons, they don't want to be, they don't want not to be able to sell these weapons, because they use that same argument, you know, that you have a right to bear arms. I'm just saying that, you know, there's no reason for a person to have, you know, thousands of rounds of ammunition like the guy in Denver or somewhere else. I mean, the young man in California.
Yeah, but you know,
when
you look at open secrets and you look at his funding, the NRA isn't funding him, as best I can tell. It seems to be construction, doctors,
money,
psychiatric workers, health systems, FedEx, Toshiba, you know. But his largest campaign funder, it seems to be U.S. Steel, and that was $17,000. And so...
That isn't even that much.
Right. Which doesn't really make very much sense. But that's for the campaign committee and the leadership PAC combined, in 2014, top 20 contributors, yeah. So...
Who's his brother? Who's his sister? Who are they related to? I mean, that would be my next question.
There's soft money. See, this is the thing about the sophistication of different groups. You can have different packs. People can advertise for you and not give directly to your campaign.
Right. It seems that it says that he's reported a total of 565 contributions of $200 or more, totaling $449,797. So, I mean, it's $500,000. I mean, it's nothing to sneeze at. But
yeah, but people don't.
Weird,
well,
like, in Ohio,
I hear you, and I'll back off of that. But that's what I understand, that there's NRA. His district in Pennsylvania. You don't have to give that, but I'll back off of that. But there is
direct
money.
It may be indirect money, and it may be these less than $200 things, and it may be just what you said. I'm just saying, from the looks of it, it's not in his top 20. It's not on
direct.
The top 20 list on Open Secrets of direct, but that doesn't mean anything indirectly, which I think is very important.
It's like the governor in Ohio, his brother was an architect, and his brother got, like, beaucoup amount of government contracts. I mean, bridges in Cincinnati, the Medina County Jail is his brother's. I mean, and, you know, and those kinds of things. So it doesn't necessarily have to go into his pocket. I mean, who's his business partner? That kind of, those things. I mean, this is a, you know, we're looking at, you know, smoke and mirrors and shell game sort of thing. So,
she's being responsible. That's what she's doing. She's being responsible that on a show that there's not a direct tie, and that's a good thing. We have to be as ethical and as we can't. Murphy and Tori and Jaffe, they don't have any problem about screwing things, but I guess we don't have to do that. But that is right, because I just can't understand why someone who's supposed to be a psychologist, why he is, you know, buying into all this.
Well, that's the biggest problem, right? That this is somebody who, I mean, on the other side, and then to top it, he was mostly, if I understand correctly, I may be wrong, but a child psychologist. And so the idea to, A, be, you know, infantilizing adults like this when you're coming from a position of child psychology, one, and then, like, to, give any thought to Barber's bill, to the way that we're mass diagnosing all of these young people fraudulently. But as a psychologist, you would think that, you know, but they're not, Yvonne, because psychologists aren't trained they're indoctrinated into the lies.
Mm. And I guess they drank the Kool-Aid and they really believe it. Okay.
Although it seems to me that, like, as a psychologist and not a psychiatrist, you would not be, you know, like, you know, psychologists who, like, support psychiatry always kind of make me laugh because they can't do anything. They don't have what, you know, they can't. Of course, there's that whole contingency that's fighting for psychologists to have prescribing rights. So perhaps he's part of that group. I don't know.
Well, I don't think so. But, you know, but So, and Charles, I wonder if he's practicing now.
I don't know if he's practicing now, but I've heard him. I want to be really careful about what I say here, but I'm 90% sure that I heard him say that he's lost patience.
Oh, he's lost patience, and in other words, clients because of his stand, or just because they just
no patients died. who have I guess. I guess died. I don't know if that was by completing suicide or from a drug. I don't know why, but I'm almost positive that that he said that. I'll find that for tomorrow night and pull that audio up because I'm pretty sure I have it somewhere. That this is part of what I think he said on the Diane Rehm show. That's where I think he said it.
Oh, well, that page is still available, so.
Yeah.
So in other words, even with treatment, he was not able to save. That's even more so. That's why some of these things have to be played back, because it's unfortunate at any time anyone takes their own life, and suicide hopelessness is a very serious thing. But I think that having the things like they talk about at the Alternatives Conference, the workshop that he got upset about, I think that some of them can be as helpful or more helpful than taking the medication, because as a person myself who has in the past had suicidal feelings of hopelessness where I've even tried to do it, I'm telling you that a pill doesn't take it away.
No. And I do think in those terms that alternatives can definitely offer something to people. Area code 240, your line is open.
Hi, this is Daphne from Maryland. How's everybody doing?
Hey,
Daphne.
How are you?
Good. You know, I am just so sick and tired of listening to, you know, people without the lived experience trying to talk to those people who are uneducated on how to help people that have mental health challenges. It really bothers me a lot. I was at a conference on Saturday morning, and I was listening to the same thing. And, you know, I don't know what immediately can be done about it. I don't know how to educate the general public about mental health, because the Alternatives Conference is so important to me, as it is important to many of us, you know, alternatives to, you know, medication. And I'll say that, you know, very honestly, yes, I'm on medication. It took me a long time to, you know, get on it, and I'm in a very low dose, and my psychiatrist does, you know, not want to push medication on me. He'd like to see me get off of it if I can. And I really like that. And the idea that, you know, somebody's out there, you know, talking about how, you know, everybody needs, you know, psychiatry or medication. It's like, no, I don't want to be walking around like a zombie all doped up. I want to make sure that I can make my own decisions and live my life as long as it's not going to harm anybody else or myself. That's it.
Yeah, and I would go one further and say as long as it's not going to harm anybody else. You know, I think that these things also become super subjective as to what's harm and who gets to say when harm is, you know, coming. But and the idea that that can be predicted. But yeah, I mean, here you have a whole bunch of people who have never had a personal experience of these things, defining them, training the general culture as to what they are, and then. You know, Yvonne, were you going to say something?
No, I was going to agree with you about the right to take your own life because some people are, their quality of life is so poor that, you know, that should be your right. If you're ill or even if you're not ill, I mean, you know, that's something that you should. But you know,
right, except danger to self doesn't even fall into. It's not even limited to suicide anymore. Danger to self. Danger to self can be that somebody thinks that the decisions you're making are ultimately going to be something that you regret in the future, and that may harm you. You know, or cutting yourself, which is a trauma response, or drinking too much, or you know, whatever that thing is, the standard is no longer to take one's own life. The standard is this subjective thing of you know, danger.
Well, it could be being homeless. I think that just like I was saying about coupling dangerousness and mental health together. I see you have to be very careful with these creeping messages. They are creeping in homelessness. And that's one of the factors, too, is that, you know, the fact that you don't have a home, that you're, you know, living on the street or you're going from, I call it sofa surfing. There are all kinds of reasons why a person could be doing that. And I think that in medical schools or something, if they, and it's like, you know, it maybe psychiatry may not be done away with in our lifetime, but we need to be teaching in the medical schools ourselves because they don't understand, and like you said, there's this brainwashing that occurs when they go to education, and it occurs for people who are doing peer work now. They get the brainwashing, too.
Yeah. Daphne, I'm wondering if you have any ideas for what should be getting done.
Mm-hmm. Daphne, are you still there?
Oh, Daphne might have hung up, but maybe...
going back.
If you want to call back in at any point, and because I am curious about what you think... should be done and how we should go about doing that, Daphne. So that would be great. But yeah, I think that the idea of these people walking around and talking as if they've had some kind of lived experience, or that they would know what, or that they would know what, you know, how to understand it, and then giving these really misguided interpretations of what it is people have.
I'm sorry. I was PMing that. I know Daphne lives in a nearby state, and I know some of her work, so I was PMing her on Facebook in case she was there as well. But they don't have the expertise. For long range, and a lot of people don't understand is that when this is why the profiling, as David was saying, and the sorting and categorizing what you, is going to be known as screening, why it can be so damaging is because once you get into the psychiatry loop, it's very difficult for people to move out. I mean, Daphne's experience and my experience is not, people that's in public health, is not the same. You know, you have to, you get in the soup and it's hard getting out. But I do think that we should be in the schools, and I think that your teaching, they're very lucky to have you. Lauren, did you hear me?
What? I'm sorry, I did not hear that last thing you said.
I said that the school that you're teaching, they're very lucky to have you with someone with your perspective.
Because I wind up having to read all of these books, that they're being trained by, and it just amazes me. One of these years, and who knows, maybe this year will be the year, one of these years I'm going to go point by point and write to the editor and explain exactly why what they're presenting is fraudulent, and that the book company should be held responsible for presenting these things as fact when they're absolutely not. And I have done that about certain things
review.
In the past. What's that?
You could do a massive literature review. You know, I wish I could find some grant money or stuff, but for people we need to have our own think tank like the Heritage Foundation, not like them, but, you know, or the Brookings Institute or a Pew Trust or whatever, so that people can come out with their original studies and documents so that, I hear Daphne's frustration because when you go to these things, like when I go to a grand rounds, it's like, you know, you just want to scream.
Yeah. Or a court, right, where somebody's got to be sitting there listening to them being told that they're, that the evidence for them being mentally ill is that they didn't answer the psychiatrist's question on demand. It really, these are just so problematic in such large terms that,
It's so bad because there are new victims coming into the system all the time. Because, you know, when people come to their primary care physician or somebody refers them to psychiatry and they have some, I'm talking about people that are seeking help, and then they get, they are before someone who has this misinformation, and they come for help, and, they start them on this regime or course that's going to, rob them of their potential, it's very disheartening. And I know that there's probably a minority of doctors, but it's still too many who have people on these extreme cocktails, and they still are very reluctant to take people, off of these cocktails to release people from restrictive supervision. And I use the word restrictive supervision because there are many people who are in restrictive supervision, more of those than people that are in a state hospital because people live in fear all the time. That's why they say they take the medication because they say, well, I have to take this because I'm getting a check. I have to take this because this is the condition of my housing. And I just wondered if someone would say, to a person, would you put heroin in your veins if someone paid you or you say that was a condition of your housing? Would you put poison in your body if someone says, well, in order for you to live indoors, that you've got to shoot up, you've got to take ingest a cocktail of Comet, ammonia, and Clorox? And most people would say, what, no? But this is what people are doing, you know. I mean, if you want to, do you want to take something that's guaranteed to have you not have sexual dysfunctioning, or that's going to guarantee to blow you up twice your weight? Most people would say no. But they don't tell you those things up front.
No, and then by the time people realize what's happened to them because they are on a drug, the withdrawal is not impossible, but difficult, and time takes time to get off of these drugs once people get to the point of wanting to, and that's if the psychiatrist will support them in that and not have them then injected, you know, because, you know, people have also called talking about how they're afraid to even suggest to their psychiatrist that they want to start coming off slowly because the response of the psychiatrist might be to put them on one of these injectables that last 30 days or 2 weeks or whatever.
Yeah. And then, you know, the fact that people are taking the injectables, where are they giving you? Are they sticking you in your hip? You know, where is that happening? It's like the rice. There's not that much difference in a lot of these medications anyway.
No.
They repackage them. You know, I see the same side effects that they have. It's just some of them are just a little bit less.
Just slight variations. David, are you back?
Yeah, I'm back. Yeah,
okay.
I was thinking, Lauren, I don't want to interrupt, but, you know, you're talking about Abilify and some of these, like, secondary drugs, which are, you know, like that you say are for, like, psychosis or whatever Haldol is used for. The problem I would think is if somebody were to look at medications, per se, they would say, oh, my God, this person is, you know, whatever Haldol's for, whatever Abilify's for, they could change the diagnosis because of the medication and therefore, you know, up the ante, so to speak, that, you know, against the person, not even realizing it, and they'll just say, well, the person's on this, so they have to be that. Not even, you know. That happens. They keep adding more and more medication, and it doesn't seem to be working, and, well, we'll just try this, and they more powerful drugs, and that might not necessarily be the solution, you know, as you've alluded to, is that, you know, it might be a temporary problem, existential kind of problem. So
drug resistant is what they term that they use for people like that. They says, well, you know, drug resistant, treatment resistant, you know, I call it using the person as a peach tree disc. You know, your Medicaid board in the state where you live, they can actually see who the, I call them serial offenders are, the polypharmacy. I remember Dr. Duckworth, I don't know whether he's still at NAMI or not, saying one time that there was no reason for a person getting a multi-cocktail of antipsychotics. You know, that, you know, why are you giving people, you know, 3 and 4 antipsychotics? Same thing with mood stabilizers. I remember talking to some of my peers when we went from not having drug coverage for people on Medicare to having Medicare D, and people were starting to look at the medications, I mean, the true believers. You know, the people, I said the blind believers, who never asked the doctor about anything about the medication, just take it, and where they get piled on, where they have, you know, the little pill box where they get 12, 13, 14 pills, and you suddenly look and you say, well, 3 of the medicines you take, they're going to cause you, they couldn't cause kidney dysfunction. But, you know, we should be, Lauren, you're asking about action. We should be sometimes looking at the I call them the serial offenders, people that actually are crippling people because we know that you don't need to be on these medications for the rest of your life, but we can't convince everybody of that. But certainly the people who are having people on a multi-cocktail of chemicals that are known to attack their liver or their kidneys or their heart or whatever, you know, that might be a way of fighting people too, is to draw attention to the fact that many of these chemicals cause shutdown of vital organs. And while, you know, one is bad enough, but if you're taking two or three, they're known to cause you kidney dysfunction. And where I live, we have more kidney dialysis places than we have grocery stores. We have more kidney dialysis
right.
places. An urban area, we always say we got a liquor store or something on every corner. We got more kidney dialysis places than we have of liquor stores.
That is something. And even I think Maxine maybe or somebody posted the other day of the from the conference from the Diabetes Association of them making that the people who are concerned about diabetes are now getting concerned about the psychiatric drugs because they're clearly seeing the link in to them. And all of these, damaging effects that that these drugs have that people aren't being informed about. What about even just like people who are elderly on these antipsychotics or heat stroke issues or young people having heart attacks from the Ritalin or the Adderall or any of that. The evidence is clear that these things, that these drugs cause bodily damage. And the evidence is not clear or not even close to evidence that there's any actual grounds for having a biological response to what is often a social, economic, environmental kind of issue.
Well, you know, some people come into the emergency room. I haven't had this happen this year, but when we've had extreme heat, like 100 degrees or more, I have in the past, not this year, in previous 2 years, have met people at the hospital because they were thinking that they were having a psychiatric incident. And what had happened was they were dehydrated. Or if they went, well, they weren't going because they were having, they were going because they had some complaint. And like Sue and some other people on the previous show talked about is the doctors don't take your physical complaint serious and they want to take you to the psych ward. And that's what it has been, is people may have a real physical condition, and then it's heat, especially if a person is taking psych meds, they can have a reaction because some of the medications make you more photosensitive than others, and people may not have enough fluids. So, you know, it can be very easy for someone to come into a place and they don't get what they need because the psychiatric label is there. And that's another danger, not only that you will be psychiatrically profiled, you might be justifiably harassed or killed, but also that your medical needs that you have will not be addressed because everything will be seen through that lens of your being a broken person.
Right.
Really. These really are crimes. Oh, David, it looks like you just got cut out again. And so we're going to actually end any moment now. But I do want to remind people of different resources like mindfreedom.org and the upcoming conference July 24th through the 27th in Connecticut at Wisdom House. And there's a new phenomenal pamphlet called Entering the Gray Zone, The Truth About Electroshock, ECT, or Electroconvulsive Therapy. And that can be downloaded for free on endofshock.com, where you can also find things like Leonard Roy Frank's Electroshock Quotationary. And we will be having some really exciting shows coming up in the near future. Tomorrow night will be an Open Lines call-in show. So I hope that people who called in tonight and who may just have been listening, who may want to call in the future, tomorrow night will be another opportunity for that. And I want to thank you all for speaking out. Yvonne, it was good talking with you. I haven't spoken to you, and, you know, now that I'm back on the ground from Bastille Day and still on a high from it, glad to touch base
okay.
again. And
okay.
What's that?
I was trying to get my papers together for Geneva, so I have been working on a campaign and some other stuff, but I always listen to it on the archives.
Well, thank you, and I hope
well,
that we can...
A lot of people are there, too, that if they can't, sometimes if you cannot listen in for the show on a particular night because you have other things that are calling you, what you can do is you can go to Blog Radio, and you can listen to the archives, the previous night's show.
Yeah, and it's blogtalkradio.com/talkwithtenny, and you can actually get all... every single episode that we've had on air there, including the specials on electroshock, informed consent, conversations that we've had with Dr. Bonnie Burso and also with Dr. Seth Farber. We're going to continue speaking out. If you have an idea for a show or would like to be a guest, or an idea, or a tip about a human rights violation or a death that you think needs to be exposed and investigated, you can call the Talk with Tenny tip line 24 hours a day at area code 718-273-8708. That's area code 718-273-8708. We will be putting out more information about upcoming specials soon. And, again, I want to ask you all to keep talking out and to keep speaking, and until next time, talk to you soon. Thanks, everyone. Have a good night.